It's like having two keynote speakers, and I know that everybody in the audience is anxious to hear him speak. Because most of us have heard him speak before, and we have a bio and the handout. I'm not going to go through that, although that's typically what one does for a speaker of his caliber. However, this may seem a bit gratuitous, but I'd like to ask, how many people in the audience have read his book? Okay. In case you haven't seen it, I know this seems a bit gratuitous, but this is, I wasn't asked to do this. This is from my heart. We got a message from Bob saying that there was a book coming out. I signed up for it on Amazon before it was even ready, a little bit skeptical about it. But I can tell you, this is a darn good book. And the other thing that I would advise to you is not to mess with this guy. Because what he survived in the first part of his life is unbelievable. It's incredible. And I think it gives us a little insight into his drive and why he wants to succeed. It's a great book. I do recommend it. I was not asked to do this, but again, I really do recommend it. I'm a pretty avid reader. I probably read 20 books a year at least, if not a little bit more than that. And I just couldn't put this down. So ladies and gentlemen, the moment we've all waited for, Mr. David Crowe.
God, I always love coming here. I feel like this is just one big family reunion for me. Probably of all the tough days I have, whenever I think about how bad Washington, D.C. can be, I spend time thinking about hanging out with you guys and just how much fun you are and what a long and great friendship I've had with Bob and so many of you in this room. So to start out, from the time I left Washington, D.C. until now, like the political world has changed, and in a way that I think could be fairly significant based on this whole impeachment thing. Now, I don't want this to take away from the bigger talk, because those of you who know me know I research a whole lot before I talk, especially to great friends like you guys. I always want to give you something I think you couldn't get anywhere else. I want to give you insights, whether they're crazy or not, they're original. And if you watch the news, you won't get what I give you. I give you something different. And part of it's from 40 years of walking the halls of Washington, D.C. Part of it is just spending a lot of time inside that process, because D.C. is really just a small town, as John Hazard and I can tell you. It's an incestuous town. It's a crazy town. And it got a lot crazier yesterday and today. So what I was going to do to start, and I guess I still will, is hold this up. You in the back of the room can't see this, but this is a picture of Joe Biden, and he's being interviewed in August by the editor, or one of the writers for the New York Times magazine. And it very simply says, Joe Biden is running to take the country back to a time before Trump. And then it says, is that what Democrats want? Do they want to simply go back and restart the Obama administration from the minute it left? Is that what they want to do? After all, this was the progress that they made. This was the first African-American president. This was a guy who pushed the envelope on many issues that the liberal community truly, truly embraced. And so part of my message will be, and you'll have to go all the way to the end of my talk, is whether fundamentally the Democratic Party has changed in 4 years from the party of Obama, even though they like him personally, to a guy that couldn't run and win today because he's not near liberal enough. So start with that. Impossible not to address this impeachment issue. When I left Washington, D.C., 135 members of Congress, all Democrats, one Republican who became an independent, wanted to impeach President Trump. Now, this group has been growing, building. Some of it goes back to the Mueller investigation, investigations about paying two females to not discuss supposed affairs he had, financial dealings that the Trump family has had, having foreign leaders stay in Trump hotels, a whole variety of just things that have just been tumbled together. And really, that began the day he was elected. So this 135 has been a fairly steady number. And they're mostly from the most liberal wing of the party, and mostly they've been ignored. Speaker Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, has been adamant against trying to impeach the president because, honestly, she probably thinks that it's better for him to be in the position he's in and run against him than having him impeached and gone and maybe dealing with a President Pence. Anyway, she's decided it would be distracting enough that she truly resisted this. And if you're the Speaker of the House, the one thing any Speaker has to keep in mind, when 218 members sign something called a discharge petition, it means that issue is going to come to the floor of the House, even if the Speaker doesn't want it. And this has happened a half a dozen times in history, and every Speaker of the House that's had it happen to them has regretted it. It'd be the equivalent of calling your board together and then deciding you weren't going to have them meet, so you leave, and they have a decision about you while you're not in the room. So 218 is a magic number. So today, at least when I left my room, 203 Democrats are on board, but so is the Speaker of the House. So yesterday, the Democratic caucus met with her and put a ton of pressure on her to move an impeachment inquiry. So what that means, for those of us who've lived through this twice, John, you and I, Nixon, Clinton, Bob, the rest of you were probably in diapers, but if, when I got out of college, I thought when Nixon got impeached, wow, you'll never see anything like that again. And then, of course, Clinton in 94, and now this. It kind of makes you wonder how many more crazy things can happen. So the impeachment process will begin. There are four committees investigating the president: intelligence, finance, oversight, and judiciary. Apparently, they will start this initiative. So my wasn't going to get to the impeachment part till far down. So here's my thought about this. Trump probably loves it. He probably can't wait, because unlike all of the other 45 presidents before him that worry about what people think and are always, you know, checking the pulse of broad public opinion, he only cares about the base. And I think as he feels, as long as he has the base, he'll be okay. Now, let me explain the whole impeachment process. You all probably know this, but if you don't, it's worth knowing. The House can impeach with a simple vote of 218 votes, and then that's it. But the Senate has to actually conduct a trial with a guy that looks a whole lot like John Hazard in charge of it. Actually, it's the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presides over a trial held in the Senate. And it's a literal trial. So those of you who are old enough to remember, that's what they did to Bill Clinton in 1994. They actually had a trial. So the Senate was 55 Democrats, 45 Republicans then, and Clinton was popular inside the Democratic Party. His numbers were good. The other part is most of the Democratic caucus and the voters didn't think what Clinton did was bad enough to have him removed from office. You know, there was the sexual stuff, there was lying before the grand jury, but in the scheme of life, the voters basically decided, hey, this isn't why you take a guy out of the job, throw him out, and replace him. So Clinton won the trial, 55-45. And when he retired after two terms, he retired as an impeached president. Whether he likes it or not, the first sentence in his obituary will be, William Jefferson Clinton impeached, and then it'll be the rest of it. Now, if we go to Nixon, before that, right when I got out of college, the House Judiciary Committee, led by a guy named Peter Rodino of New Jersey, that committee passed articles of impeachment. This is after 2.5 years of Watergate. So Nixon, who had at least 45 at least, I think it is, senators thought, well, I'm going to get 2/3 plus 1, take 67 senators to vote to convict you, to remove you as president. Then you're removed. So he thought he was going to be okay. But on the night of August 8, 1974, a man named Barry Goldwater, who was the John Wayne of the Republican Party, and probably the most influential Republican, excepting Reagan, of the last 30, 40 years, including the Bushes, made a visit to the White House. He said to Nixon, pour us both a strong drink and let's have a talk. And so Nixon said, well, I'm going to survive. And Goldwater said, you're going to resign tomorrow. And here's why. You're not going to put the Republican members of the Senate through what they're going to have to do to defend you. You're going to tear the party apart. You've already really, really hurt the party. And you won't survive the vote because Republican friends of yours are going to have to vote against you, including me. Nixon probably had more than two drinks. The next day at noon, he wrote a one-sentence letter. I effectively resign the office of President of the United States. He got in a helicopter. He flew out. You didn't hear from him. Now, part of that reason, and the reason I tell this story, is Nixon truly loved the Republican Party. He made all the mistakes that he made, but he was a lifelong Republican. He started out after the Navy as a congressman, then a senator, then a vice president, and then a president. He had the unbelievable long resume of somebody that spent his entire life in the party. And what Barry Goldwater is basically saying is you're destroying the party that you helped build. Nixon at that point knew game over. Okay? Donald Trump is not Richard Nixon, not by a long shot. Now, before we get to Trump, I'm going to tell you about one other impeachment. For the history nerds of the world, and I know there are a bunch in here, I'm looking at you, John. You've read a lot about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. He was Abraham Lincoln's vice president. This is not all that well known. You have to be a real nerd to have read a bunch of books on this, and I would put myself in that camp. What happened is after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, basically, Johnson, who is from Tennessee, Lincoln put him in the vice presidency because he wanted America to heal after the Civil War. And he thought putting a Southerner as VP would help that, not expecting to get assassinated, of course. And Johnson was a Republican barely, if at all. The only reason that Lincoln picked him beyond him being a Southerner is he was the only Southern senator not to vote to secede from the Union. Other than that, he was a Southerner in every single way, which meant he went immediately as president and reinstated most of the landowners in the South, let them buy their citizenship back, and basically went back to a world minus slavery that was exactly the way it was when Lincoln was elected. Well, this really, really, really made the Republican Party mad because they had fought 4 bloody years to win a war that had been erased just like that. And moreover, all of the former slaves now counted in the Electoral College. So suddenly the South had 43 more members of Congress than the North. And the North saying, how the hell did this happen to us? And so Johnson vetoes Civil Rights Act. He continues to let Southerners get their property back. The plantation owners, they get to vote. They get all of their rights back. And so a guy named Thaddeus Stevens, who could be today's modern Adam Schiff or Nancy Pelosi, decided they weren't going to put up with this. They hated Johnson. Hated him with a passion, maybe almost as much as Democrats hate Trump. It was right up there. So they tried to impeach Johnson three different times. Like, what are you going to get him on? That you hate him, you hate his philosophy, you hate everything about this guy? So they finally found a law that had been passed saying you can't fire any member of the cabinet. And of course, Johnson had this big fight going on with the then known as Secretary of War. He tried to fire him. Well, the Secretary of War, being a persistent fellow, slept in the office, would never leave. Wife had to bring him food, clothing, bed sheets. And so there was about a year standoff on trying to replace this guy. So the Senate, Thaddeus Stevens, said, we've got him. We have found the thing. He fired this cabinet member, and he's trying to put another guy in. They impeach him. Now, historians will say, that is no reason for an impeachment. And in fact, the law was struck down, but not yet. So Johnson gets impeached. The entire House dumps on him. We have a trial in the Senate. Well, lots of corruption, lots of things going on in the Senate. He survived by one vote. Therefore, was not impeached and removed. Now, I'm going to make the case that Trump fits into Andrew Johnson, not Clinton, not Nixon. Donald Trump is a guy Democrats hate. There is no amount of hate words you can use to describe it. The day he was inaugurated, you had the next day a million person, mostly female, march against him. The city near where my office is, not far from John's, was destroyed by looters. Just smash all of the banks and the Starbucks and the cleaners, all of the storefronts, they destroyed it. And somehow they got away with not being considered rioters, looters. But they rounded these guys up. And as you know, the hatred against Trump has never stopped from the moment of the swearing in. Now, having lived through Watergate, having lived through the Clinton inaugural, and having read about history, I'd say from Lincoln on, now Lincoln they tried to assassinate 13 times before he even got there. He came in on a train underneath where the luggage is at night with two Pinkerton agents covering him with a cloak so they wouldn't see that it was him. Now this isn't that bad, but it ain't far away. And so Trump is almost as hated as Lincoln was, and certainly more than Nixon during Watergate by a lot. So you've got that. You've got the Mueller investigation. You've got the two women that he supposedly paid off. You've got all these financial deals with his hotels. You've got all kinds of stuff. So the Democrats have been just waiting for this chance. And now they believe there's a smoking gun with this phone call to the president of Ukraine. We'll give you your missiles. We'll give you money. By the way, I have a favor I need to ask of you. I need you to look at Joe Biden and his kid. And so that's the gist of it. Did he force the Ukrainian president to do anything? I would make a case he didn't force anybody to do anything. Did he suggest it'd be really nice if your attorney general and mine and Mr. Giuliani got together and figured this out? Yeah, he made that sound like a real good deal. Did he say, then you can have your missiles and your aid? Yeah, he said that. But this won't be about, did he violate a national security edict? Did he get bribed? Did he offer a bribe? This is all falls into the category of I hate your guts and I can't wait to take you out. And one of the things Nancy Pelosi has worried about, one of the reasons she really avoided impeachment until now, is she didn't want this to become a mud fight with Trump's base versus the rest of the country. Because Trump's base is about as rock solid as it gets. And anybody that gets in a fight with Donald Trump, it was a lot like my German Shepherd puppy that got in a fight with that porcupine. It seemed like a great idea until the third swat in the nose with all those little barbs. And then it wasn't such a good idea because this guy will counterpunch you to death. And they didn't want that. But now they've pushed that. So we have to start with that. Now I'm going to make the case for Trump. John, I'm going to make a strong case for Trump. then I'm going to make the case against Trump. And you're never going to know how I feel. Unless you get me drunk tonight, then. I might say all kinds of stuff. In fact, for the right amount of scotch, I'll just spill my guts. The case for Donald Trump, and you listen carefully because we're going to re-elect him. One, the day of the election, 98% of all pollsters said he will lose. 98. The spin control was so good that in the days after the election, people like Nate Silver, 538.com, Gallup, Quinnipiac, were all trying to spin it that they were less wrong than the other guy. Never a great position to be in. You think I'm wrong, Bob Lagosse is really wrong. Okay. So 98% are wrong. The only 2% that got it right, well, said Romney would win, said McCain would win, said Gerald Ford would win. People didn't get this. They didn't understand his strength. He's got a strength, and a lot of that strength came from two things. These pollsters aren't stupid, but they also tend to follow the pack. They'll ask you, have you voted in the last several elections? If you say no, I'm not even listening to you, because you don't count, because you're not going to show up. You're just a big talker. You're going to get a beer, you're going to yell at Fox, you're not going to vote. So you're out. Do you usually vote Republican? Oh, I'm an independent, but I voted Republican 6 straight times. Got it. You don't want to go to a cocktail party with your wife and have somebody scream at you because you're a Trump guy. I get it. So you're an independent. Independents really aren't independents. On both sides, they almost always follow one party. They'll say they'll always vote for a good person from the other party if they ever come along. They never come along. Just doesn't happen. So Trump got people who had not voted in 20 years or more. And lots of them. Lots and lots of them. Pollsters who said, have you voted? But I love Trump, I'll vote this time. They ignored it. They all voted. They all voted. And so he not only won 6 states that Obama had won 4 years ago, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida. Obama won those 4 years earlier. He won all of them. Not only that, he flipped 206 Obama counties. 206 is a bunch. He flipped them. And that just doesn't happen. In your polling data and your sort of mindset, that doesn't. People who voted, who've never voted, who vote, and people who say, oh, the hell with it, I'm going from Obama to Trump. Doesn't happen. It happened. Now, part of the reason is Hillary Clinton was one of the most, if not the most unpopular, Democratic nominee in 100 years. I know I felt that way. So Trump had basically the same amount of negatives, but he had positives she didn't have. He had a lot of positives. Now, you can say, okay, it was luck. In 3 states, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Trump strung together 77,411 votes in those 3 states to win, while losing the popular election by almost 3 million votes. Extraordinary, one in a million. I can't imagine the odds against that happening. It happened. And he won 304 electoral votes. That's a bunch. That's my case for him. Let's continue. Trump's base is as strong a base as this country has ever had. Yeah, the downside of it is it's somewhere between 41 and 46% of us. Dipped to 38 once in July, once after the government shut down. It was back up to 43 or 44 the day I came here. Don't know what it is today, but it's steady. As he said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and still get elected. And he basically has proved to you, yes, he can. So he's got one hell of a base. So he hit 46.1% on election day. Hillary hit 48.3%. But most of her huge plurality was in California and New York. those were wasted votes. Because in the Electoral College, it's winner take all. What Hillary never counted on was in losing the industrial states of Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and she didn't think she'd lose in Florida. She actually never went to the Midwest for the last 7 weeks before the election because it was in the bag. She had it. And when she went to Pennsylvania, she traveled with Beyonce. She did one event with LeBron James. She never actually did the meeting and greeting and talked to the people in the towns, even when she was there. So Trump did that. And anybody who's been to a Trump rally, raise your hand if you have. Wow. Okay. I do these things so you won't have to. I watch the debates so you won't have to. God, you're not paying me enough for that, believe me. But those rallies are like World Wrestling Federation events. You should go. Grease yourself up. Offer to wrestle a pig. They're wild, right? And you saw them everywhere. I compare the Trump rallies to the 1948 whistle stop campaign of Harry Truman. Truman was never supposed to win that election. He was behind Dewey the entire time. But he took a train across the country. And there were thousands and thousands of people at every single stop. And if you were paying attention, not that I was alive in 48, I really wasn't, it was clear he was more popular than the polls were showing. Now, the polls then just did telephone calls. A lot of people didn't have a phone, didn't even have a Wi-Fi account. So they missed those people, and they didn't get it right. Trump had that kind of thing going for him. Now, what did he run on? What did he tell you he wanted? Besides make America great again, take it back to a simpler, stronger time where we had manufacturing, we had blue-collar jobs, we rewarded church, we rewarded people who are in the military, we treated our American folks right, we were kind to veterans, we made sure there were good blue-collar jobs. He wanted all of that back. Now, one of the reasons he was going to be able to do it, he's going to build a wall. And he's going to get rid of your rapers and all your bad people that are coming here, not only causing crime and eating up our social services, but taking our jobs. From the moment he flew to the Mexican border in the Republican primary on, he was never behind, ever, including Election Day. He knew he had a gold mine in that issue. What else did he tell us he would do? He'd give us tax reform. He did it, and that was a good tax bill. Businesses have been helped. The stock market went to almost 27,000. You now have the lowest unemployment rates since records have been kept. And not only just for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants and Catholics, but Hispanics, African Americans, new immigrants. The job, they always say that anything below 4% is really zero because that means that you don't want to work. In the minority community, some places down to 3.8. He did it. We have a strong economy. His tax bill helped that. And he has fought to bring jobs back. Now, what else did he say he would do? He told us that he would give you a great new set of trade agreements. That these trade agreements have been terrible for Americans for decade after decade. They never are fair. They never treat us right. And he attacked. And attacked and attacked, and he's still doing it. So to replace NAFTA, we have USMCA, as it's called, which is NAFTA Part 2. He hopes to get that through. He is working on trade agreements with Japan, with the EU, and we know he's got this massive fight with China. Now, what's he saying about China? You're liars, you're cheaters. You steal intellectual property. You're never honest about any of the things you do. You surveil us when we come over. You steal our stuff shamelessly. And you don't trade fair. That's what he's saying. And even people who don't like how he's doing this would say, yeah, that's what's going on in China. So he's got a lot riding on getting it right with China. Because right now, this trade war is hurting both of us, right? and it's hurting a lot of our allies. But he's been willing to fight those fights, and he doesn't let up. And people who are in his camp love that. They love that. Even when he's inconsistent, when he zigs and zags, they think he's fighting for them. He owns that space. Romney never owned it. McCain never owned it. H.W. Bush never owned it. W. owned it for a while, particularly after 9/11. But no other Republican, all the way back to Reagan, has been thought of as fighting hard for what they said they would do when they got there. So if you only cared about the economy, where we are today versus the day Obama left, you favor Trump over Biden by 63%. Huge. And maybe that's not being calculated correctly, because he's done it. So then let's look at things he hasn't done that Democrats wanted him to do. The elephant in the room is climate change. He got out of the Paris Agreement. He says this is just folly for rich idiots and elitists, that none of this stuff that they're recommending would do one thing for the environment. It just enriches people who have wind farms, solar farms, and do all kinds of fancy stuff that really doesn't create jobs and basically rewards the countries like China and the developing countries and make us pay trillions and trillions of dollars, and we get nothing except losing that money. He has made that a very, very strong part of his administration. Healthcare. He said, I'm going to get rid of Obamacare, and he's gone all out to do it. Now, like anybody who tries to touch healthcare, it's tricky, and it never quite comes out the way you think it will. And so, but he tried, and he tried hard, and he pushed hard. So now you'll see people trying to replace him are trying to brag about how much free healthcare you'll get. And we're going to go through that whole debate again. But he has truly, truly tried on those issues. And so that's the case for him. Now, before we go to the case against him, let's look at our political divide. Right? They didn't do a lot of polling when Lincoln was president. They haven't done a lot of polling until the last sort of post-Eisenhower World War II. So when you say, was Andrew Jackson more popular than Donald Trump, it's a whole lot like saying, could Babe Ruth hit 2019 pitching and be a World Series champion, or is he a guy that hit a ball about that big and they were throwing it easy? I don't know, and I don't care, because you can't compare it. What you can look at in the last 40 years is the polarity between the parties. Now, I've said often, and hopefully I haven't bored you with this, if you go back to 1960, 3% of us had college educations. 97% did not. If you were the CEO of your company, your employees didn't make near as much as you. Maybe you had a bigger house if you're the CEO. You probably had two cars, and you probably had a nicer vacation. But your kids played on the same little league team. Your house wasn't that much bigger. You may make three times what I make, but we're basically not that far apart. If you go to where we are now, it's extraordinary, right? You've got many, many billionaires, and you've got such a tremendous divide between have and have not, and it's increased the polarity. So compare the top three Democrats that are running, Sanders, Biden, and Warren. 38% of the Republicans have a negative opinion of her, of them. And you say, that's a pretty big number. 91% of Democrats have a negative view of Trump. And I'm guessing in the last 48 hours that number even went up. And that's extraordinary, because if you go back to 60, Kennedy and Nixon, and even all the way up to Gore and Bush, there was a pretty good size overlap. You had a lot of Southern Democrats who were more conservative than Northern Republicans. And you didn't have as much hatred and class divide. That is such a big factor of change now, you almost can't measure it. Here's a statistic I think helps. You have to think about this a minute. In 1996, Bill Clinton won or lost 1,125 counties. That's a third of them. By less than 10%. Either won or lost by less than 10%. So you had a lot of competitive counties. When Trump won, the counties that were 10% or less were only 310. So what's happening is Democratic areas are getting way more Democratic and Republican areas are getting more Republican. It's urban, suburban, it's rural density, it's a lot of things. But we've become almost two societies separate from one another. And it shows politically. So there were a lot of rural Democratic senators, congressmen from the upper Midwest states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota. Now it's either pure Republican or pure Democratic. That whole divide has become complete. So that's something that is changing the nature of things. So when people come to me and say, I don't know a single person who's a Democrat, I know where they live. I go to urban areas, I don't know anybody who voted for Trump. I know where they live. I see this all the time. You do too. So this political divide has created big problems. Now, this isn't the first time when George W. Bush beat Gore and you took 32 days and he won in the Electoral College and he lost. Almost 81% of the Democrats at that moment did not like him. Understandable. Romney had a pretty big gap too between Romney and Obama. It was in the 80s. But it's crept up. And I'm guessing over the last 24 hours, it's gotten even higher. Now, here's the gut-wrench question I ask you, you that represent the real America. Is this correct or is this not correct, what I'm about to tell you? So let's start with 2016. White women without college voted for Trump. He carried them by 27%. He carried them by a lot. Today, if polls are right, these same women, white, non-college educated, are tied. Biden and Trump are tied. Trump has lost 27% of his female, non-college educated, white voters. Now, let's get into urban and suburban college educated Democratic women. That is with high skill sets, good jobs. Trump is behind them, behind 70% to 30%. 30% will say they liked him. So when you win in the Electoral College and you lose by 3 million votes, you cannot lose your non-college educated white women when they were such a big block. So are they lost? Are they quiet? Are they not telling pollsters the truth? Are they going to pull the lever for a Democrat next time? It's a big question. So remember this. The way this country has continued to divide, if you took, there are 435 congressional districts, there's 50 states, and there's 538 electoral votes, right? So think 435, 50, 538. So if you look at our counties, our congressional districts, are roughly 700, 800,000 people. You multiply that by 435, and it's roughly the population of this country. Every 10 years, they readjust it with the census. We're about to go through that in a year. If you just line those districts up, the first 17 that are rated by whether you're college-educated, most of you in that district, or 100% Democratic districts, you get to the 17th district, counting down, before you get one that voted Republican. That's growing each election. And that's a big deal. There was a time rural, college-educated folks voted Democratic and some urban people voted for Republicans. That's gone. So let's look at the other weaknesses that Trump had. He had no honeymoon. Every president gets a honeymoon. Even George W. Bush got a honeymoon before 9/11. Bill Clinton had a honeymoon, one hell of a honeymoon, apparently, apparently with several people. Most presidents get a honeymoon. Is it 3 months? Is it 6 months? Is it 9 months? Or is it till the first time you screw up? You get one. Obama had one, a nice one. Trump didn't even have a wedding. He didn't even get back to his room before the other side just tried to kill him off. He never had a minute where there was a peaceful day where he could say, I'm president and I'm basking in the glow. There was no glow. There was nothing. And it really has not changed, and I've never seen a time like it. Certainly not since I've been in Washington. Gerald Ford got a nice honeymoon after he pardoned Nixon. He almost won the next election. People liked him. There's none of that today. Now let's look at the 2018 midterm elections. Midterm elections are so called because they're between presidential elections, right? Every 4 years we vote for a president, every 6 years you vote for a senator, every 2 years you vote for the House of Representatives. So you vote for the entire House of Representatives in a mid-year vote, midterm, and a third of the Senate, the way they rotate them. So the most important number in a poll before a midterm election, any election, but especially midterm, is what they call the generic. Now what that means is people who vote all the time, black, white, female, male, doesn't matter, they poll them, are you going to vote? And they've always voted. And if you vote for your member of Congress in a non-presidential year, you're considered a really strong voter. So raise your hand if you voted in the 2018 midterm. So a lot of us did and a lot of us didn't. That's no criticism. A lot of people don't bother unless the president's on the ballot. They just don't. And it's one reason midterms can be turned by smaller events, right? Because you have a smaller, more focused group voting. So the generic in a midterm election means something, because if you tell me I vote every midterm, I've not missed one, I'm believing that that counts. Probably also means you voted in the primary. Probably also means you voted for dog catcher, county supervisor, your state senator, your state house member. You're engaged. So that number means something. If the Republicans are only behind by 3 to 4, they can almost always win because their reliables are more reliable than the Democrats generally. The old corny saying, they punch above their weight, they always show up. If it's a driving rain, if it's a blizzard, they're still showing up. So if the generic is around that 3 to 4, and 4 is a little high, but within 3, Republicans are still okay. The generic in 2018 for Democrats was 9. You're going to get beat in a lot of places. And they did. So right before the 2018 midterms, when all the polling came out, 46 Republicans did not seek re-election. That's a big number. Only 20 Democrats didn't seek, so you're more than 2 to 1. Going into 2020, we've already had 19 Republicans announce their retirement with only 7 Democrats. So generally, that's a sign things aren't going well for your team. This is not a great sign for the Republican Party at the moment. But I will remind you, there will be 2 World Series champions, a Super Bowl, and 9 games into the next NFL season before we vote for president. You got nearly 400 days. This is just another day, right? And Trump's not a guy that's going to go away unless they carry him off in handcuffs. So now let's look at kind of the final issue. We know how many people are going to vote for impeachment, and let's just say he gets impeached, and let's just say he doesn't care. Let's look at the Democrats' greatest weaknesses, then we'll do their strengths last. So if you look at the Democratic Party, the people running, and you go back to my picture of Joe Biden, Joe Biden thought that when he announced, it would be his nomination hands down. He was a 2-term vice president. He was a six-term United States Senator. He's known by probably 99% of the public. Everybody likes Joe. Joe Biden's a nice guy. I'll tell you how nice a guy he is, and this is true. When Strom Thurmond and Jesse Helms died, two very strong Southern Republicans, they put in their wishes that Joe Biden speak at their funerals. This was a guy that got along with everybody. This was a guy that returned everybody's phone call. This was a guy that basically everybody liked. Even if you didn't like what he stood for, even if you thought he got lost and rambled, you liked him. Joe Biden's got more positives than you can add up, even with his age. But when he started to run for president, on his first day, he had 27% against a field that only, other than Bernie Sanders, had single digits. And he has slowly slipped down. In the debates, which I've watched so you don't have to, he has been savaged by his opponents for not being progressive, for not doing enough things to give money, to give benefits to the people. He has been savaged for not supporting the Green New Deal. Green New Deal, by the way, if you read it all the way through, zero fossil fuel, there'll be no air flights, there'll be almost no cars unless they're electric. You just won't be doing that stuff. You'll replace it with what I call the medieval age. That was a great time. Saber-toothed tigers, you had your club, you had your loincloth, and you just kind of went out and ate organic because that's all there was. And if you read that stuff, that's what they're saying. And so when somebody says, I'm going to do a $3 trillion climate change, another Democrat will go, that's nothing. I'll do that on my first day. So you've got some stuff out here that's way further than what Obama did when he signed the Paris Climate Change. What else are these Democrats asking you to do? Well, they want guaranteed minimum wage all 50 states for all the jobs that are there, period. They want tariffs on any type of good anywhere in the world where they don't think the worker is being treated the way they ought to be treated. And you go to China and India and places like that, as some of us have, and you understand making them do what you think would be very difficult. Some would call it impossible. They want price controls on college tuition or just free. And even though the college tuition debt is bigger than all consumer debt, forgive it. Instantly. And that's $13 billion and counting. Just let it go. Let it go. They also want, several of them, a guaranteed wage for every single American, no matter what you do or don't do. So if you're alive and you're above 18, you get $25,000 a year just for being there, because it's a human right. Healthcare is free. It's a human right. Housing is free. It's a human right. It's a human right. You have no right to deny it. Medicare for everybody. Now, this is one fun part of the debate. I sometimes don't know if I drink too much or not enough. I just can't figure it out. Bernie Sanders is having a discussion on the debate stage, and he says, well, my plan's $33 trillion over 10 years. And so a couple of Democrats who said, that seems like a big number, Bernie. Well, I'm talking, Biden's plan's $874 billion. It's not even a trillion. I think it's 0.75 trillion. I never got that right. And Bernie said, we're going to spend $50 trillion anyway. Wouldn't you rather spend $33 trillion instead? And all 11 other members are looking at, what the hell is he talking about? My plan gives everybody access to all the medicine they want, but it'll cost $50 trillion unless you do my $33 trillion. Then several of them get into bigger arguments, not bigger arguments than that, because that's pretty big, about who would add the most people to Medicare and who they charge. And Elizabeth Warren, and watch her, because I think she's slowly creeping up, she says, oh, I've got it. We can take care of all this. Free college, free housing, free medicine. You can still buy your own if you want. Well, all we need to do is tax the top 2%. and we'll take all their trillions and all their billions and we'll feed it directly into the social programs. Biden's over on this corner going, what the hell happened here? I'm Barack Obama light. I'm doing what Barack did. And he's finding that other than liking Obama personally, the Democratic Party doesn't like anything that he did. And poll numbers showed this. He didn't do anything. He wasn't liberal enough. He wasn't progressive enough. And I have left out, of course, gun control, which I hate to bring up, but that too, like climate, will be one of these generational issues that does not go away. So the Democrats say Obama really didn't do anything, even after Sandy Hook. He started the Paris climate thing, but no money had been spent. He didn't really get involved in raising federal minimum wage. Obamacare crashed and burned, and he barely was able to survive picking up some of the pieces. He's a lousy president. He wasn't liberal enough. He wasn't progressive enough. Now, Joe Biden, we don't want to go back to where we were with Obama. We don't want that. So this is something that's going to create a lot of trouble in the Democratic caucus as they move forward, because each of them are trying to go to the left of the other. And it's going to get to a point where, honestly, somebody in this country actually reads what this stuff means. Because the Green New Deal sounds great. No petroleum, no cars, no airplanes, no cattle. We just go back to a simpler time. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. I'm crying. I know my grandfather Crow, who died pulling Johnson grass until the day he fell over dead, would be doing triple somersaults in his grave if we thought we were going back to before he was alive. But that's what the Democrats say they want. And they're saying this in strong numbers. And beyond the fact that Biden occasionally feels befuddled, he's getting hammered. And that's why I think Warren moves up. Now let's look at legitimate issues, which I'll call legitimate, that I think both parties and the next generation are going to have to deal with, that all have strong political undertones. Let me give you a couple statistics that are, I thought, are pretty interesting. If you took the net worth of Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, and Google, they are bigger than the economy of every country on Earth except the United States, China, Japan, and they're tied with Germany. Those four companies are $1 trillion more in GDP than the entire United Kingdom. If you're a young person today trying to get a job and trying to break through these tech giants, it gets harder and harder. I'll give you something else that ought to upset people in terms of news and information. So Facebook has four products that have more than 1 billion users, four separate products. Google has eight products with over 1 billion users. When the Wall Street Journal decided to fight back against Google, so a big fight on advertising dollars. Bob probably knows this better than any of us. If you're doing a newspaper, you're doing any newsletters, you survive on advertising. You go back to when I was a paper boy, the entire paper was supported with print ads. And they were pretty good ads, right? So what has Google really done? Since 2007, half the newspapers in America have disappeared, a little more than half. And that number has grown all the way up until 2019. So you think, well, is Google really being unfair? So the Wall Street Journal got mad at Google and decided to fight back because Google was taking their articles, not compensating them, and then running a bunch of ads where they got money. They're doing this to everybody. So the Journal put up a paywall trying to stop it. Within 6 months, the Wall Street Journal lost 44% of their advertising and had to let go of it. So now, between Google and Facebook, and there are a lot of people near my age, 90% of the people in this country get their information from two sources. That's it. So maybe you read a variety of things through Google. Maybe you read a variety of things through Facebook. But that's how you get your news. And they get 100% of those advertising dollars. So they're strangling the press. It's strangled. And if you look at how these monopolies have really done this in a very rapid time frame, they've created fights with both parties. But the millennials are the ones that have to fight this fight, because they're the ones that are really benefited from it and are now suffering from it. So when you look at these monopolies, Apple makes $151 million a day. Every day. The CEO of any of these five companies will make more money in the first hour and 15 minutes than their average worker will make in a year. A lot of this underlying class tension between the parties is coming from this. And it's only going to get bigger and bigger. So, prediction time. Will Trump survive to be in the race in 2020? Somehow I believe he will. Somehow I believe he won't get convicted in the Senate. I think the Senate Republicans probably don't think that's going to help them. This isn't something they have to do. Now, if something else incredible comes out, could have while I was up here, that could change. But I'm guessing that 67 senators, considering 54 Republicans, aren't going to do that. Can he win next time? 400 days, folks. Can he do a deal with China no one has ever done? Can he straighten out trade with Japan, the EU, Canada, and Mexico? Can he do some economic miracles? Can he do some things with Kim in North Korea? Can he make that go away by becoming his friend? Can he do other bigger things? Because he's such a risk taker. He can. And the fact is, he's been dead more times politically than any of us have ever been alive. He's always dead. Every day I would get up and I'd see, Trump's done it this time, he's completely finished. And I'd say, oh, this is really the worst, he's done. Oh, no, this is it, constitutional tipping point. That's been going on for 3 years. So this latest constitutional tipping point that's now worse than any other, we'll probably wait for tomorrow's, right? So the Democrats' best chance to beat him is to be completely united. They're not. They have 23 candidates. Now, I know a couple have dropped out, probably ones you didn't even know were in. Only they and their spouses knew. Like, I'm thinking about dropping out, just seeing if I... Here's my book, Buy the Pale-Faced Lie. By the way, good book. I'm dropping out. I'm not running for the presidency. I've had enough. It's not my time. Like, I could actually probably get 100,000 hits on... I might do that. So some of the guys that have dropped out are nothing. And I love their press conferences. This was not my time, and there never will be one. Thank you. So Trump can make that number hit 46, 47 again. What would really do it for him is if the party nominates Biden and you don't get the progressive wing behind him. And they go, oh, Jesus, just another tired old white guy. Won't even do as much as Obama did. Won't do the New Green Deal. Won't do gun control the way I want it. Won't do any of the things that I want done the way I want them done. You could see Trump winning another close election. You could. You could see 5, 6, 7% of the people voting for none of the above or some third person or whatever. Because this guy's base is something that only he gets. So Alin was saying, if you go back to 2016, where Trump's standing on the stage with all these people, five senators, four governors, Jeb Bush, who's, you know, the son of a president, the brother of a president, the grandson of a senator, all of these great people that ran against him, he's the only one that really understood the mood of the party. He's the only one that got it. The rest of them got beat without even knowing how they got beat, right? So he's got that feel for the pulse. Now, some would say he's wearing all that out. You're exhausted. Oh my God, not another Trump story. But I'm guessing that's true until you pit him against a Democrat that is so liberal for you, you go, Jesus, he's just fine for me, thank you. Because Trump's going to run some ads. He's a tough guy. Some might even say he has some elbows. Those ads against the New Green Deal, against Bernie Sanders' $33 trillion Medicare for All, when you read it, some of the other things that the party is pushing, and they're not getting much publicity around it. And that's the way it happens in the early days. Most debates are won on style points in the early days. In the last debate, which you were fortunate enough not to see, young Juan Castro, who's from Texas and who served as HUD secretary from Obama, decided, well, I'm at 2%, so I'm going to try to knock Joe Biden out. Kamala Harris tried it the debate before that. So it's like, I'm at 2, you're at 27, I'm just going to chop you up and say you're an old fool. We did it so hard that it actually had a backlash and people like Biden better. So that's what happens to you when you get tons of candidates. It's what happened to the Republicans last time. Guess how many Republican primaries are going to be between now and Election Day? Zero. Nothing. Trump's got the biggest war chest by far. These Democrats have got an odyssey to go through, and they're going to keep getting hammered more and more and more left. Can they come out of it and unite their party? Of course they can. Don't count Trump out. Thank you.